One of the dominating problems of the 20th century was how to organise ourselves. There were just suddenly so damn many of us and growing all the time. For a long time, we had run things in a top-down fashion with power flowing from the top. And as our numbers grew, we took this to totalitarian extremes, communism, fascism, and, as it found itself expressed in the science fiction of the time, Big Brother. We assumed that was how computers would work as well. And when Thomas Watson, the head of IBM, commissioned a study to find out how many computers the world would need, the answer came back, 6. And he was determined that IBM would build them all. Well, instead, there are computers on our desks, in our homes, in our cars, in our phones, in our TVs, in our pockets. They're not power devices, they're information devices. They go where they're actually useful, where the information is, which is where we are. And networking allows us to share it with each other directly. However, it takes a while to shake old habits, and since we've all been brought up under top-down government and top-down us-and-them media, we look at the sprawling mass of the internet, and the question we naturally ask is, but who's in charge? Stuart Kaufman, an expert in complex adaptive systems, has the answer.
Nobody is directly in charge of the internet. It's an astonishing thing that it works. It is our example of and leading cause of open programming, where lots and lots of people contribute code that gets co-assembled and seems to work, which is sort of wonderful. But then, you know, nobody's in charge of the food supply in New York City, and there's only 3 days' supply of food, and nobody's worried about it. So the world has an awful lot that is self-organizing, in the sense that the players manage to create it without there being anyone in charge. Another fine example, by the way, is British common law. It keeps evolving and adapting, and there's nobody who's, quotes, in charge of British common law. It's what I like to call the puzzle of why systems actually can co-evolve with one another and accumulate complexity, which we've obviously done in the biosphere and the econosphere over the past 4.5 billion years.
In other words, we are involved in an evolutionary process here. The phrase paradigm shift is now vastly overused. A new soft drink, for instance, is not a paradigm shift, but Darwinian evolution is, and it's one we've scarcely begun to get our heads around in the century and a half it's been with us, because it turns everything we intuitively understand about the world on its head. What evolution shows us is that complexity arises from simplicity, that design flows upwards. Not exclusively, of course, any more than gravity means that balls don't bounce or birds don't fly, but overwhelmingly. In our time, the idea that design and complexity flows upwards has expanded out of pure biology and started to illuminate, well, just about everything else. No more big computers handing down information. Instead, lots of tiny ones sharing it. Brozel Haslacher, nanotechnologist.
You're not going to have this general-purpose machine lying around. You're going to have lots of little things, little machines that do special things for you, and they'll be transparent to use. And you could even sprinkle them on the ground. They'll be so cheap, and you could pick them up and use them and throw them away. I mean, that's almost an ideal an engineer would use. Disposable objects that are quite sophisticated, but because they're built out of new molecular film technology, they're so cheap to make that you can't take them apart, and who cares if they're washed away or stepped on, or you can't trade them because they're everywhere. If you want one, you go to the next street and pick one up. And that's going to change everything.
Before long, computers will be as trivial and plentiful as chairs, and then as pieces of paper, and then as grains of sand. Instead of calculating with streams of electrons moving around silicon chips, we will be calculating with beams of light, with organic molecules, and then, as quantum computers arrive, with other universes. It is as if we are part of a huge multi-billion-year project to turn dumb matter into smart matter. Should we be excited or alarmed? In Britain, we tend to be alarmed by change. After a century in which we lost an empire and found Mr. Blobby, that is perhaps not surprising. But the future is invented by those who are excited about it, and it has never been as inventable as it is now.
You featured largely in Douglas's writing career. No, not you, the listener. You, the universe. And he certainly left his mark on it. The map of the heavens is studded with extraordinary names, and many of them have some significance with the history of our own Earth.
The mythology of ancient civilizations, stories of Greek gods and goddesses, Shakespearean heroines, the inventions of the Enlightenment. So much of our culture is reflected in the stars. However, some space names have nothing to do with science, but reside in the world of the imagination. Space fiction and fantasy have names every bit as strange as reality, and sometimes the two cross over, as in the work of Douglas Adams.
When I first started writing science fiction, I actually got a sort of star atlas and would start looking through for names of stars. And for some reason, anyone I came across would never be quite the one I wanted, never be quite right. So that's why you do end up inventing them. In fact, I don't know why I even thought of trying to get them from a star atlas. I think that there was some notion in my mind that I wanted to make this seem as real as possible by naming actual stars. But of course, most people haven't heard of any of these, so it didn't really make any difference. Magrathea was one particular one that gets featured very heavily in the first Hitchhiker book, and that was the planet where they make other planets. I mean, essentially, I think it's not so much that it sounds spacey, but it does sound like a real name. Another one was Damogren, and that, again, had a sort of solid feel to it. I mean, you believe in this as the name of a place. I mean, oddly enough, I mean, a lot of real stars do have extremely silly names. I mean, one that a lot of people who were possibly not as familiar with astronomy as perhaps they might have been assumed that I invented the name Betelgeuse. Or Betelgeuse, as it, I think it's meant to be pronounced, which is a perfectly genuine name of a star not very far away from us. And that actually sounds as if it's silly, whereas I think Magrathea or Damogren actually sounds much more like it might be a real place. So what is it that gives a name a real sound? I don't know, there's got to be a sort of good sort of solid weight to it.
Perhaps those astronomers who are faced with the challenge of finding names for new worlds could borrow back a few from the rich seam of science fiction. Then the planets Krypton and Vulcan can proudly take their place in the registers of the International Astronomical Union.
Astronomer Heather Cooper there in her BBC radio series Naming the Universe. And 2 years later, the International Astronomical Union had a singular honour in store for Douglas. But it was to be an honour that tragically he would never delight in. We've reached V now, nearing the end of our alphabet. And here are a few thoughts Douglas had about virtual reality when he was a guest on Desert Island Discs, recorded in 1993.
When you begin to talk about the machine, as it were, almost replacing the human brain, then one begins to think, well, is the human brain so outdated? Is that what you're saying?
Our brain last evolved. We last physically evolved. We're not certain exactly when, but it was a long time ago, of the order of a million years or so. So we essentially have a perceptual system and a set of instincts and a set of pre-programmed responses to the world and ways of perceiving it and understanding it that were appropriate to us as cavemen. Now, one of the things we have in our brain is the ability to create tools, the ability to change our environment to suit ourselves. As a result of that, we have created a world that has outstripped our ability to comprehend it. Now, this phrase virtual reality needs to be explained because, in fact, we all live in virtual reality. We think that the world is a sort of solid, vivid place full of sort of shape and color and solid objects like this table and this microphone and so on. But we actually create that in our heads out of the bits of information that hit the back of our eyeballs or hit our eardrums or hit our tongues or whatever. It's very, very raw data, and we have wonderful pattern matching systems inside our head, which we use to synthesize the world which we then move and walk through. But there are all sorts of things we don't see, we don't hear, patterns we fail to respond to, things that get filtered out because they were not appropriate to cavemen. What the computer in virtual reality enables us to do is kind of recalibrate ourselves so we can start seeing those pieces of information that are invisible to us but have become important for us to understand.
But in that sense, then we would never need to go anywhere. We simply kind of put on a helmet and enter this virtue. We can walk through the Alps or, you know, go and have a look at the San Francisco earthquake.
Well, it's funny. I remember thinking when I was in Bali doing Last Chance to See, because somebody had been talking to me about virtual reality at the time and saying, you know, this is going to be a terrible idea because people will, you know, go on holiday in their machines rather than, you know, going to lovely places like Bali. And I went to Bali and I thought, well, Bali is, or rather was, a wonderful place. And it was a wonderful place before people all started crowding into Bali, trying to make it more and more like the place they'd just come from, you know, filling it with T-shirt shops and hamburger shops and bars and so on. And I began to realize that we were actually making an artificial world out of Bali.
So better to sit at home in Neasden and put your helmet on.
And leave Bali to be what it was. Yes, I think so.
Only 3 years earlier, in the Hyperland documentary, Douglas had presented his own vision of what high-tech virtual reality might look like 15 years on from then. But this was to fall far short of even present-day achievements. In recent years, advances in computer technology have become almost exponential. Take CGI effects in movies, for example. It has now become almost impossible to distinguish between physical and virtual reality, and Douglas embraced that development with a fervour, keen to exploit it in the planned Hitchhiker movie. The partnership between virtual reality and science fiction has indeed attained a new high. And talking of science fiction, I feel a W coming on.